Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moscowane. It's estimated it'll take $1 billion for any single presidential candidate to run a competitive campaign ahead of November's general election. Democratic candidate Hillary Clinton is leading the pack in fundraising at about $300 million, according to the latest numbers from the Federal Election Commission. Rival Bernie Sanders is still attracting a lot of money, though Sanders is spending his cash at a much faster rate. And presumptive Republican nominee Donald Trump, up until recently largely self-funded, is now building a traditional campaign infrastructure as he newly courts the big donors. We catch up to all of this and what it means to any candidate's electability. And we also are going to get the latest on the email controversy casting a persistent shadow on the Clinton campaign. Joining us from our NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Byron Tao, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Welcome, Byron. Do we have Byron?
Thanks for having me.
Oh, hi, Byron. And Josh Stewart is with the Sunlight Foundation, an organization which tracks political dollars. Good to have you here as well, Josh.
Happy to be here.
So first, let's tackle the latest on the email imbroglio. Byron Tao, the State Department's Inspector General, has found Hillary Clinton violated federal rules by using a private email server to conduct official business while she was Secretary of State. But did she break the law?
Well, you know, that's the big question here. The report did not delve deep into whether she broke any criminal laws. Does note that she did not follow the proper procedures outlined in the laws about archiving, meaning that she took a lot of her emails with her when she left office and didn't give them back till almost 2 years later after her lawyers had reviewed them. In addition, the report spells out the fact that, you know, she should have sought State Department approval to use this off-the-books email system, and that the rules are pretty clear that this is simply not allowed under the State Department's policies.
At the same time, she says she was playing by the rules. How so?
Right. You know, so she says, and her campaign says, and has said repeatedly for months, that this was all allowed, that there were no prohibitions on the use of a private email server. And this report found that, yes, it's true that federal employees do occasionally use their private or personal email for government business, but that's supposed to be brief. You're supposed to follow the right procedures. You're not supposed to transmit sensitive information over your personal email server. And she was doing it exclusively, and they found that this has only happened 3 times in the State Department's history, and that one of the people that did this was an ambassador in Kenya, and he was ultimately he resigned over this in part.
So one of Clinton's arguments, you know, is that some of her predecessors as Secretary of State, including Colin Powell, followed similar practices. This does not let her off the hook.
That's true that Colin Powell did exclusively use a personal email account for government business, although the report notes that the State Department's rules about cybersecurity became much more stringent and strict in the mid-2000s, and that Secretary Clinton should have known better and seen much more detailed guidance than Colin Powell, who was Secretary of State in the early Bush administration. So they did single out that difference. They said that awareness of cybersecurity risks was much greater now than it was in the Bush years, and that she ultimately should have known better that this was against department procedure. Mm-hmm.
Josh Stewart, our primary focus this hour is on campaign finance. So does this hurt Hillary Clinton moving forward?
From what we're seeing, it seems like Democrats at this point, you know, the Democratic primary is still slogging along. And at this point, her sort of curry and the favor she's getting from fellow Democrats is pretty high. Now, there is still some question on whether or not she can effectively unite the party, what Bernie's role is that, and how the last few states will play out. And I think that will all factor into it. Right now, we don't see that sort of affecting her financial numbers. They're pretty healthy in terms of what you would expect, and in terms of what she's promised in terms of her fundraising prowess, which has been sort of impressive this whole way through. The only thing she's lacking at this point is the robust small donor base that Bernie Sanders has had.
And Bernie Sanders is largely avoiding the email issue. Donald Trump is calling this a disaster today. So what do you make of this? Does what Donald Trump says affect Hillary Clinton's fundraising efforts?
It's unclear. I doubt Hillary Clinton's fundraising efforts will be affected by Donald Trump. What you often see campaigns is they turn it around, right? For instance, if Donald Trump goes after Hillary Clinton, the campaign will then send out an email to supporters and say, you know, the campaign is under attack. We need your help. Chip in $5, $10, $15. Mm. And I think that's sort of how the sort of punch counterpunch works. And you'll often see partisans rally to Clinton's side or Donald Trump's side, depending on this issue. And, you know, this is sort of consistent with what we've seen with the Clintons for years, is that any issue around them is quickly polarized, right? And the email scandal, though valid, is certainly one of those things.
Byron Tao, the FBI investigation will continue into the email controversy. Do you expect any smoking guns here?
Well, no one really knows. The FBI has been very careful and methodical about its work. We don't actually even know what they're truly looking at. There's been all sorts of rumors whether they're just looking at mishandling of classified information or whether this is a broader inquiry into Secretary Clinton's time at the State Department. We simply don't know. What we do know is there's no evidence that a grand jury has been impaneled yet. And that would be a necessary step towards any indictment. So right now, it doesn't look like there's a tremendous amount of legal peril for Secretary Clinton in this FBI investigation. But of course, that could change depending on what they find. And we expect her to be interviewed by the FBI in the coming weeks.
Okay. Well, to campaign finance and back to Donald Trump. Of the candidates, the three candidates remaining, he's raised the least money, but he's also spent the least. But the general election's a different game entirely. He's got to change his fundraising strategy. He's been doing so recently. Why is the general election so much more of a challenge than the primaries have been for a largely self-funded candidate like Donald Trump? Byron?
Well, in the general election, you have to build out operations in, you know, a dozen or more swing states. You have to put field organizers on the ground. The American people pay a lot more attention to the general election than the primary. Ad rates go up. Sometimes you're in big media markets. And so it just does cost a lot of money. And part of it, the general election involves the Democratic and Republican parties in a way that the primary does not. And that's much more staff. That's many more resources. That's ad makers. And so it just costs a lot more to run a sophisticated general election campaign these days.
Despite Trump's differences with the Republican National Committee, he's entered into a fundraising partnership with the RNC. And Tuesday, we learned that some big GOP fundraisers have signed on. Josh Stewart, we've got billionaire Diane Hendricks, Woody Johnson, owner of the New York Jets. How much punch do you think they add to Trump's efforts to gain footing against Hillary Clinton in the money race?
I think it's pretty significant. I mean, I think there was some concern, though I was skeptical of this concern, but I think there was some concern of Trump being able to unify sort of a disparate group of the donor class, many of whom have ideological differences with Trump as well as rhetorical differences with Trump. And he seems to be doing okay by that. One of Ted Cruz's big backers, Toby Neugebauer, who donated $8, $9, $10 million to Ted Cruz, has sort of also endorsed him, and that's also endorsed Donald Trump. That's an indicator of things are going pretty well on that front. Sheldon Adelson wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post basically urging fellow Republicans to get on board and pledging, I believe it was about $100 million of his own money. And we'll see that go into super PACs. We'll see that go into the party and various other groups. And it seems like not everyone is falling in line, but he's getting a few folks every day, a few more folks.
Yes, he is having trouble winning some significant donors. Paul Singer, Joe and Marlene Pickett, the Koch brothers.
Yeah.
So does he have to get these folks on board to be successful, Josh?
I'm not entirely sure he does. I mean, today he actually came out and said that he isn't going to be able to raise $1 billion. He's going to be able to raise $500 million. Now, it's unclear, you know, what he actually thinks about that, which has sort of been the nature of Trump's campaign. But I think The Koch brothers, for just to use that as an example, have said they're going to instead invest in Senate races and congressional races across the country. Now, if those ads are distancing those Republican senators from Trump, I think that's more problematic. But if all of them are sort of playing from the same playbook, I think that's a very different nature of sort of a rising tide lifts all boats. But again, with this election, that rising tide is usually the president, the top of the ticket, the presidential candidate. Mm-hmm. And I do think that where you're seeing other donors go, which is congressional races, I think that could be problematic, though it's still really early. It's only May. We're a long way from the conventions and we're a long way from November, and a lot can change in terms of what these donors decide to do. We call, at the Sunlight Foundation, we call certain PACs pop-up PACs because they'll pop up pretty quick. They'll have $1 million, $2 million, $10 million in, and they'll go in an ad buying spree, and they'll have a significant impact. So in the span of a few weeks, all of this can come together and totally change.
Sure. Byron Tao, does Donald Trump not need some of these big donors?
Well, it's a good question. He does seem to have a committed grassroots fan base, which could provide an alternative method of financing his campaigns. And if we look at the primary, Bernie Sanders pretty much went toe-to-toe, if not outraised Hillary Clinton in the long haul, using mostly small donors. And she had a pretty big, high donor operation. She has the support of most of the Democratic finance establishment. And he managed to outraise her, even though he is on pace to lose the nomination. So Donald Trump could do something similar. And, you know, we say he largely self-funded, but the truth is some of his campaign was funded by merchandise sales. Mm-hmm. And, we could see his fans, his supporters chipping in small donations and small amounts of money and help offset any financial disadvantage he is at vis-a-vis Hillary Clinton.
So the number that's being tossed around is you need $1 billion to run a successful campaign. $500 million, big difference. But can Trump make this work because of all the media coverage he's been getting? Byron?
Well, I think that's the billion-dollar question, so to speak. He did not spend or raise a significant amount of money compared to his rivals in the primary, and he still won. It is not impossible to see him also rewrite the general election playbook. On the other hand, I am skeptical. Sophisticated modern campaigns these days rely on all sorts of things like analytics and targeting and field operations and get out the vote. And Trump seems more skeptical of these things than other political figures. But, veteran consultants say that this is the way you win elections. This is the way you turn out your voters. This is the way you ensure that you'll win in November. And if he's not going to spend in those places, certainly there are alternative means to winning. But, I would be surprised.
All right. As we head toward the national conventions and the general election, we're taking a look at how presidential campaigns are funded. Byron Tao of the Wall Street Journal is with us this hour, along with Josh Stewart of the Sunlight Foundation. This is Ballot Talks. If you've got questions or comments, feel free. Give us a call, 888-477-9499. More of Radio Times just ahead. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moscowane, and this is Ballot Talks. How are the remaining major party candidates for president planning to raise the estimated $1 billion each it'll take to run successful campaigns during the general election? We're taking a look this hour with Byron Tao, a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Josh Stewart, who is with the Sunlight Foundation, an organization which tracks political dollars. Lines are open at 888-477-9499, or send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. A tweet works as well, at WHYY Radio Times. So Hillary Clinton is working with the Democratic National Committee via a joint fundraising effort called the Hillary Victory Fund. She signed on with the DNC for this back in August. Trump signed on with the RNC for a similar effort this month. How much does Hillary Clinton's running start help her, if at all, Josh Stewart?
I think it's pretty significant, and I think this goes back to the ability to use every tool at your disposal to be competitive in a general election. And it takes a long, long time to build a donor base that you can go out to time and time again. And the Clintons have their historical donor base, which is, you know, been around since the late 80s, early 90s. And then they are also building a small donor base, which they also hope Bernie Sanders' small donor base can come on board. Now, that latter part is it remains to be seen. But to sort of Byron's point earlier, this is something that Trump is going to have to work very, very hard at. And I think Hillary has a slight advantage at this point, just in terms of fundraising.
And Byron Tao, Donald Trump was quoted this week as saying he's working with the RNC in the joint fundraising effort only because they want him to. This is to explain his about face from, you know, a campaign he earlier touted as not beholden to big donors and special interests. So does this sort of explanation help or hurt him with potential donors?
Well, you know, his supporters, I've been across the country in this election cycle, and one thing that Donald Trump supporters often say is that they like that he is not bought and paid for by big money, which is also something that Bernie Sanders' supporters say about him. But there is something to the idea that the Republican National Committee wants their presidential nominee to help them raise money. You know, a lot goes into long-term party building. A lot goes into building digital infrastructure. A lot goes into hiring field organizers and opening field offices. And these things can last beyond a presidential campaign. So it's really no surprise the RNC is eager to tap him to help them raise some cash for the party's long-term viability and success.
So you don't necessarily think his supporters will be put off by the fact that Trump is now courting big
money? That's a good question. Trump is an interesting phenomena. You know, he's reversed himself on big issues. He sort of speaks his mind. And one of the other things that his supporters like about him is that sort of frankness and directness. And so, you know, nothing else seems to have hurt him with the electorate. And, mm-hmm. and as we move towards November, things get even more polarized. People divide into their traditional, whether they lean Republican or Democrat. And so, you know, I don't necessarily see it hurting him, especially given all the other controversies he's courted since entering the arena last year.
Josh Stewart, contenders, you know, like Bernie Sanders also get a crack at joint fundraising with national political committees, correct?
Yeah, that's absolutely correct. And you've seen some controversy around some sort of back and forth between Bernie Sanders and Hillary Clinton around this issue. But the reality is both nominee, all the candidates in all the parties have an opportunity to set up these sort of committees, because it's in the party's ultimate interest to raise the sort of money for a lot of the reasons Byron pointed out. Infrastructure is key not only for this race, but for governor's races in 2 years and Senate races and all sorts of down ballot races and just mm-hmm. general party building.
So, well, how does Sanders' effort with the DNC stand?
Not well. There's been a sort of a contentious relationship, one might say, between Bernie Sanders and the DNC.
Yeah.
Some of that I think is rhetorical in nature, but I do think there's some very deep disagreements here about how the party should be run. And I think some of that will be resolved at the convention. But I think Bernie Sanders, at least from what we've seen in how he's raising money, is he's looking to elect like-minded candidates and maybe be a little bit more of an agitator in the party. He recently endorsed the opponent for DNC chairwoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz, which is sort of unprecedented a little bit, because you have a sort of second place contender for the Democratic nomination endorsing the opponent of the chair of the party, right? Mm-hmm. And I think you see him playing party politics, but maybe not in the way that we sort of see as sort of like a team player. He wants to remake the party a little bit, and so far the dollars are sort of proving that to be true, that is where his priorities are. Now, again, a lot can change as we get closer to the convention in terms of his role. But I think that sort of behavior is something we'll see a lot more from Bernie Sanders. I don't think we're going to see six-figure check fundraisers from Bernie Sanders.
Mm-hmm. Interestingly, you know, Sanders has been given five representatives to, help craft the Democratic platform, including a pro-Palestinian activist. What do you make of that, Byron Tao?
Well, it's certainly, Bernie Sanders has talked a lot about wanting to change the way that the party operates, namely the way it chooses its presidential nominee And he seems to be willing to take that fight to the convention. And then there's also some side fights that, you know, a couple of his platform committee appointees are very critical of the way that the U.S. Postures towards Israel and the Palestinians and would like a more even-handed stance there. That could be a big controversy. And then there's Bernie Sanders' supporters who are, you know, independently of the campaign, planning to go to Philadelphia and show up in support of him. And, you know, I've talked to a few of them and they say we're trying to be peaceful, but we're behind the changes that his campaign proposes 100%, and we would like to see major reforms in the way that the Democratic Party nominates presidential candidates and runs itself. And so this all adds up to a potentially messy situation in Philadelphia in July, though I should warn that there is the potential for a lot of this to be worked out in advance and that the Democratic Party would like a smooth convention if possible. And so we're just going to have to wait and see how this all shapes up.
Yeah, stay tuned. Well, we've got no surprise calls and comments coming in here. Dan writes, it's interesting that the two unexpected campaigns from this year, Trump and Bernie, both agree that there is too much bad money in politics. Trump seems to have done an about face in regards to working with the RNC and naming potential SCOTUS nominees that might agree with Citizens United. Is Hillary Rodham Clinton committed to ending Citizens United? Is there ever going to be meaningful campaign finance reform? Josh Stewart, you want to tackle some of that?
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair question. I think the first part, when it comes to the rhetoric in the campaign, I think, you know, there's the bad money, there's good money. I mean, there's all kinds of money in politics, and I think reasonable people can disagree. But I think most Americans, when they see six-figure, seven-figure checks going to a joint fundraising committee or a super PAC, it raises eyebrows, right? Sort of across the board, I think, too. And I think with the change in the Supreme Court and potentially a new Congress and a new president, I'm not sure we will see robust campaign finance reform, but the opportunity to do meaningful reform and, in what Sunlight views, add more transparency to the process, I think that opportunity will be there. And I think what you're seeing is substantial voter enthusiasm as well as rhetoric from every candidate. I mean, Hillary Clinton, though she is raising big money, back in September issued a pretty comprehensive campaign finance platform. Bernie Sanders has one. We've yet to see one from Donald Trump in terms of a comprehensive policy platform. I'm doubtful we will, just based on history in terms of other policies he sort of promised to put out. But I do think ultimately this rhetoric will come to a head, and I do think a change of Supreme Court creates the room for that, because a lot of people were discouraged about putting out meaningful reform. And one more point.
Okay.
You're seeing the states move on some of this too. You're seeing states like Maine. You're seeing a red state like Texas require more disclosure. A sort of light red state like Montana require more disclosure. Blue California require more transparency. And you're sort of seeing movement. And historically in America, the states have been laboratories for good policies. And we hope to see that continue. And hopefully that'll influence federal policy as well.
All right. Calls are coming in to 888-477-9499. Let's go to Steve in Bucks County. Hello, Steve.
Hello.
Hi.
So I was calling in to ask, one of the guests had earlier mentioned that the Trump campaign might suffer because so far they've eschewed like advanced analytics and sort of conventional statistical analyses on races. But I'm interested to know, to what extent has the Trump campaign so far sort of undermined the conventional political classes' prognostication? And so to what extent would the advanced analytics or these kinds of political consultants really be that helpful to his campaign? And I can take my answer off the air.
Sure. Thanks, Steve. Byron Tao, he surprised the pundits at every step.
Question from the caller, and it gets to a sort of really philosophical one, which is, do campaigns matter? And because politics is something that happens so infrequently, there are so few elections, we can't really run experiments. That's something we don't know. You know, when a campaign like Barack Obama's wins, we tend to look back and say, oh, it's because of all the big data. It's because of their great analytical program. Well, maybe it was just because he was the candidate that more people wanted and that the campaign didn't matter. And I suppose if Donald Trump is going to run an analytics-free, sort of data-free, sort of, you know, field organizer light campaign, we will be able to sort of test how much of a difference these things make. And I should also note that there is not a direct relationship between – there's not always a direct relationship between the amount of money a candidate spends and has and how well they do at the polls. We've seen some pretty stark examples of self-funded candidates that poured millions of dollars of their own money into campaigns only to really flame out and lose. And so, you know, it does raise a very interesting philosophical question of how much do political campaigns matter and how much is just the mood of the electorate. And we'll see, I guess, is the answer.
Well, in 2012, Democrats spent just over $1 billion for Barack Obama, while on the Republican side, slightly more than that was spent for Mitt Romney. And of course, Mr. Obama handily beat Mr. Romney, despite having somewhat less funding. In short, how much does narrative count? Josh Stewart, what do you think?
I think narrative is critical. I mean, just to dig into those numbers a little deeper, I believe outside sort of negative spending, right, so sort of the negative ads you see, I think Romney and the Republicans, it was either 2 or 3 to 1 in terms of that. I believe they topped about $300 million in opposition to Barack Obama and the Democrats. On the other hand, the Democrats had a lot less negative advertising. But to Byron's point, they were using sort of targeted data to like reach out to voters and find voters that they needed. Now, again, is that exactly why they won? It's unclear. But I do think I had a professor in grad school once said, you can have the smartest campaign, but if your candidate doesn't have the magic, none of it matters. And I think that's very much true, right? And I think you've seen that with Bernie Sanders, who has not sort of enough maybe to win the nomination, but he's tapping into something very real with the party that a lot of people didn't expect. And you can make a similar comparison to Donald Trump too. He sort of found a to use his terms, a market failure a little bit, and started reaching out to voters that, you know, they wanted to hear his message, and they responded to it.
Byron Tao, if Bernie Sanders stays in through the Democratic convention, and it looks as if he will, how does this affect Hillary Clinton's campaign war chest through the end of July and her ability to campaign against Donald Trump?
Well, sure. The ongoing Democratic primary battle, which at this point looks like it will go through June at the very least, and you know, there's a possibility it goes to the convention, does harm her ability to sort of pivot to the general election. It would look presumptuous in a lot of ways if, say, she started her transition planning or she started sort of fundraising for the general election, although she's probably either is or about to start doing that. So, and she does have to deal day to day with, you know, barbs and attacks coming from both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. So it certainly is not an ideal situation. I mean, she and her campaign are sort of ready for general election mode. They would like to be done with this primary battle. And Bernie Sanders has other plans. He says he's going to stand through the end, which we should note is what Hillary Clinton did in 2008 against Barack Obama. And, you know, she said that is his right to do so. But it does have an impact on her ability to prepare and to move forward with a general election message.
Okay, we've got an email from Peter who asks, do either Clinton or Trump or Sanders have their money in blind trusts? What is the standard practice, if there is one? And has anyone asked what their plans are? Trump said his kids would run the business, but that doesn't say what happens to his ownership. No. So, Byron, you want to take a crack at that?
Actually, I'm going to defer to Josh, who seems to have a good idea on this.
Yeah, I mean, that's actually a really good question, and something that's been the focus of our policy folks over at the Sunlight Foundation. I think I can't speak to exactly the nature of Hillary Clinton's finances, though historically both Clintons have had a blind trust, and we've known this because they disclosed their tax returns, and they've just done that year after year, right? And that's how the media and advocates and activists can sort of confirm that information. Donald Trump is a lot – it's a big mystery, sort of what is going on there and what exactly the nature of his finances are. He is certainly not publicly committed to putting finances into a blind trust. He hasn't put down a sort of substantial plan. And we don't know the current nature of his finances because he has not disclosed his tax returns and has said it's none of your business. Now, transparency advocates like us at the Sunlight Foundation obviously, you know, disagree that it's none of our business. And, you know, we would prefer disclosure so that way we can have a full picture that we believe the public deserves.
Yes. And Josh, if Trump does not disclose his tax returns before the general election, he would be the first presidential candidate since 1973 to refuse to do so. I mean, there's no way to force his hand, correct?
There is no way to force his hand. I mean, this is Richard Nixon started doing this, right? And so if he's not hitting the bar for transparency of Richard Nixon, I think that speaks a lot in terms of his priorities around transparency and political disclosure and government disclosure. I will say though that the norms have sort of failed, right? So normally people, the media, advocates, activists sort of start requesting that candidates release their tax returns, and it's voluntary. It's entirely voluntary. And there's some disclosure they submit with the Federal Elections Commission, but it's pretty limited. And so this process of voluntarily disclosure has worked great because there's been a relationship with the media and the media pressure, and it sort of worked. Donald Trump, like many other things we've discussed today, has defied that. And we think that's a problem. And we're, you know, we think Congress should sort of look into this and perhaps, you know, sort of mandate this by law so that way we can ensure this sort of transparency in the future again, because, you know, a 40-year-old norm is sort of, you know, going to the wayside, which, you know, Trump seems to get a kick out of doing that with a lot of different things.
In about 10 seconds before the break here, Josh, do you think his supporters will care?
Polls are showing that his supporters don't, but the majority of American people do. So we'll see how that plays out over the next few months.
All right. This is Ballot Talks. Josh Stewart of the Sunlight Foundation is here along with Byron Tao, reporter for The Wall Street Journal. If you have questions or comments, the number to call is 888-477-9499. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. There's more of Radio Times just ahead. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain. This is Ballot Talks, and we're talking about the major party candidates for president and their plans to raise an estimated $1 billion each. And Donald Trump, he's thinking it's a $500 million, what it's estimated to take to run a successful campaign before the general election. Byron Tao is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, and Josh Stewart is with the Sunlight Foundation, an organization which tracks political dollars, and they are both at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, or a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. So let's look at the joint fundraising efforts via the National political committee. State parties can sign on to these efforts. How many are working with what's called the Hillary Victory Fund, and how many for the Trump Victory Fund? Byron Tao?
I think off the top of my head, it's more than a dozen for each of them. And this has really changed presidential fundraising, I should note. In 2012, Barack Obama, the most he could ask for from any donor was about $70,000. And then in 2014, there was a Supreme Court case called McCutcheon that basically tossed out this aggregate limit, the total amount of money a donor could give to candidates in one cycle. And now we can do financing sort of in concert. So this means that Hillary Clinton can ask each individual donor for about $350,000, and that's each donor. And Donald Trump can ask each donor for about $450,000. And the money gets split between his campaign, the RNC, and a number of state parties that have sort of signed on to this agreement, and same with the Hillary Clinton effort. And so this is a real big sea change in the way that we finance presidential campaigns and funnels a lot of money to state parties and state efforts. Yeah. It funnels a lot of money back to the DNC and RNC and is really a marked change from the way we've done things before.
If a state party does join a fundraising effort, is it seen as an endorsement of the candidate, Byron?
Well, at this point, I think because we have a presumptive nominee in the Republican Party and a likely nominee in the Democratic Party, that state parties would be sort of foolish to turn down any funds. And also, you know, looking at their finances over the past few cycles, state parties have really struggled. Money started moving into super PACs around 2010, and their coffers dried up in a lot of ways. And this is bringing money back into their system. So they're not going to say no to a presidential candidate on either side of the aisle being willing to help fundraise for them. And I think in the Democratic Party, Hillary set hers up pretty early, and that was not seen as an endorsement, and they would have been happy to take Bernie Sanders' money as well.
Donald Trump is now headlining some fundraisers, which require some hefty donations, $10,000 and $25,000. But I've read that Hillary Clinton is commanding six-figure fundraisers. Josh Stewart, why do you think this is, and is it a game changer potentially?
I think he's catching up. I think that's why you're seeing him sort of engage in these sort of big money fundraisers. And I think you're going to see, you know, right now you're seeing these five-figure dinners. And I believe the one in New Mexico was technically billed as a rally. I'm not sure how many rallies cost $10,000 a head to get in. But I do think that's an indicator of what we're going to see from Donald Trump, right? I think moving forward, you're going to see not only five-figure fundraisers, but you're going to see six figures, and he's going to reach out to his donor base to try and get, you know, like Byron said, that max amount, which is the $450,000, because he has a lot to catch up on. There was no candidate like a Hillary Clinton on the Republican side that has been raising big money just directly going back into the parties, right? So they have a lot of catching up to do, but historically, the Republicans have been very good at that. So I am not too sympathetic to their position, because I have full confidence that they will be able to bring the donors home and raise the money needed to at least be competitive.
Hillary Clinton has attended a number of mega plate events now, and they're quite often small and one-on-one, held at a supporter's home. Byron Tao, what do you think typically goes on there? I'd love to be a fly in the wall of this sort of gathering.
Well, that's a good question. We don't know, because journalists
you're not
are typically
there.
Not permitted to enter. But, you know, most fundraisers involve, you know, speech from the candidate. A lot of these donors see giving money in some ways as a sport or a hobby, and the proximity to a candidate like Hillary Clinton, someone who's been in public life and is an important public figure and maybe the next president of the United States, is important to them. And they usually get a photo, there's usually a dinner, and there's usually discussion and opportunity to ask questions of the candidate there. And that's likely what is going on at these gatherings. And yes, they're quite intimate. I think the few she did in New York City or around New York City were about a dozen people, maybe more, but very small, in a private home.
Just wondering how much of an ear, you know, they might expect to get from, you know, from the candidate, any particular donor, you know, or they're just, maybe it's really you get the snapshot at the end of the day and a chance to air your views.
Well, in a dinner with 15 people, I suspect there's a fair amount of FaceTime. Again, we don't know. These are behind-closed-doors fundraisers, and sometimes you can get the attendees to talk about them. And by the way, occasionally the waitstaff will leak videos of them, which is what happened to Mitt Romney in 2012. So, you know, but we saw him giving a fairly candid speech to donors in that tape, and one that got him in trouble.
Yeah.
But, you know, I suspect there's a pretty candid discussion between the attendees and the candidate that is otherwise, you know, not quite what I don't want to go there. But, you know, these are candid discussions.
Yeah, yeah. Can this sort of high stakes fundraiser, though, be thrown back at a candidate who might seem to then be out of touch with the lower middle income voter? John,
yeah, I certainly.
Byron?
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I do think that is a problem. And that was, I think, why Hillary Clinton avoided doing a lot of these at the height of her primary battle against Bernie Sanders is because his critique of money in politics was at the center of his campaign, and he was accusing her of being so tied to special interests and a participant in what he called the corrupt campaign finance system. So, and I do think voters reacted to that in a lot of ways.
Okay, moving forward, we're going. We'll go back to the phones now. Chris, in Ballykinwood, you're live on Radio Times. Welcome, Chris. Chris, are you there? Okay, let's go to Rick. I believe he's calling from Delaware. Rick, welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you very much for the show. Interesting topic. I wanted to ask you, I consider our system quite crass as compared to other countries that lived abroad a long time. Don't you think that one of the issues that we have is crass system, that it attracts crass people like the former governor of Illinois with the Elvis hairdo, that's kind of some of the people that we attract in our political system, rather more than thoughtful people, reserved people that don't want anything to do with this crass system. It's just awful.
That's a good question,
Rick. I'll take my answer off the air.
Thanks. Well, John Kasich didn't make it very far. So what, you're talking about quiet, you're talking about thoughtful. Has the tone, the tenor of the presidential campaign, the typical presidential campaign changed, say, over the last 3, 4, 5 cycles? What do you think, Josh Stewart?
I mean, I'm certainly not a rhetorical expert, but I do think there's something there about the frustration. You know, the system, what it takes to run for president or even run for Congress is, you know, for instance, a member of Congress, 4 hours of call time a day, the 20 hours a week of call time. Then you have to attend fundraisers in the evening. You have dues you have to pay to the party. It's a grueling schedule, and that is a high bar that people have to meet in order to enter into public life. And so if you just have the campaign finance part of it, it is discouraging for a lot of people to get into it. And then you add the other elements like the scrutiny and everything that comes with it. It is difficult. And I think that does prevent perhaps a lot of good candidates for entering into public life. And I think that's why there's a lot of appetite for reform and the rhetoric around reform, not only to our campaign finance system, adding more transparency, perhaps looking at some of the big money issues. But, you know, you see movements around voting rights, voter participation, you know, controversies over voter ID law, and all of this stuff has to do with the public's trust. And I think that also affects how and what type of candidates get in.
Okay, I understand that we now have Chris from Ballykinwood, Pennsylvania with us. Hi, Chris.
Hi, how are you? Sorry about that.
That's okay. What's your question?
So I heard, I believe it was Mr. Stewart from Sun Life, who was describing Donald Trump's reluctance or refusal, I guess, to disclose his tax returns. And the reasons I was hearing had to do with transparency and this 40-year-old tradition and sort of this comparison to Nixon. But I didn't really hear anything substantive. I guess my question is, why do we need to know his tax return information? When he says that it's none of our business, I'm sort of inclined to believe him, and I'm just wondering what the benefit as the public it is to us to know it.
Okay, thanks, Chris. Josh?
I think it's critical mostly because, you know, the presidency is such a big office. It's such a powerful office, and it's all-encompassing, and we deserve a full look at those candidates, you know, and I think there should be, I think privacy is absolutely a valid concern, but just because we have to think about privacy doesn't mean we have to default to some sort of opaque process, right? I think the more we know about our candidates, the better, and I truly believe there's a middle ground between protecting like reasonable elements of someone's private life, but if someone wants to be the president of our nation, they need to meet a higher standard of disclosure than maybe, a lesser public official in a lesser elective office or just an average private citizen.
Let's talk about lobbying in the remaining few minutes we have this hour. The perception that the candidates for president have distanced themselves from lobbyists and special interest money is not necessarily accurate. Is it, Byron Tao?
That's true. Donald Trump well, all three of the candidates have sort of backed away from the norm that President Obama set in 2008 when he ran for president for the first time, that he would not accept any contributions from registered lobbyists, and he would make it difficult, though not impossible, for them to serve in his administration. Hillary Clinton has a number of very prominent Democratic lobbyists who are raising money for her and who are active in her campaign, and she has not made a similar pledge that she will keep the president's restrictions in the White House if she were to win. Bernie Sanders has no prohibition on accepting lobbyist contributions, though there are not too many of them. There are some trade associations and industry groups, people that work for those groups that have given to him. And Donald Trump has sort of brought on a team full of folks who are veterans of the K Street sort of foreign government lobbying world. And that includes Paul Manafort, who is his chief strategist and who has done some foreign government work, including for Ukraine and some other countries. And so there is a real backing away from the norm that the president has set, which is just a norm. It's an executive order, could easily be reversed as soon as he leaves office. And, you know, that perception, even though there's tons of anger out there in the country about special interests, that they kind of clawed their way back into the political process.
How much does Donald Trump need those possible foreign government connections should he win the White House, Byron?
Well, you know, it's never, you know, it's never harmful to have relations to other countries. On the other hand, there are concerns about being a sort of paid agent for these governments for years, which is what Mr. Manafort was. And I should note, he has not done that work in a while, more than a decade. But, you know, he did at some point. And so that's just sort of how it shakes out.
When let's get to the Citizens United decision briefly. When it was handed down by the Supreme Court, I think it's 6 years ago, there was grave concern regarding super PAC and other money and the influence this could wield in elections. How has it impacted this presidential cycle to date, Josh Stewart?
I would say it's been mixed. It's mixed results, but the biggest impact is the inflated nature of spending so far in this cycle. I mean, you have sort of the examples like Jeb Bush's super PAC Right to Rise, which spent about $100 million, you know, basically to no avail. And then you had other examples where you could see candidates able to stay in the race a little bit longer. I would point to Marco Rubio, who was able to stay in the race in the primary a little bit longer because he had the support of a super PAC running ads on his behalf. Now, just to be clear, we've seen, you know, the primary is sort of an example of Citizens United light, right? You know, I think when you get to the general, the spending is going to balloon. You know, I mean, we talked about, you know, in 2012, $300 million against Barack Obama, $100 million against Mitt Romney. You're going to see those numbers go up on both sides. The Clinton-aligned super PAC Priorities USA has pledged to spend $90 million in the early summer against Trump. I don't know what early summer means, but that sort of implies that there's a phase two to that level of spending, right? And so I think across the board, it's going to be big. And I think another thing of particular concern are these are super PACs. Say what you will, they're transparent. They're transparent things. You know, we know who their donors are. We can track their spending. There are these entities, we call them dark money groups. And the, you know, for the tax nerds out there, these are 501c4, C5, and C6 sort of categorized groups in the tax code. And they're allowed, thanks to the Citizens United decision, to make independent expenditures for and against the candidates, which are sort of ad spending. And they're also allowed to run issue ads, which are very hard to track, but often portray candidates in negative light.
Okay. Well, that about wraps it up for us. We're at the top of the hour. Josh Stewart, great to have you here. Thank you.
All right, thank you so much.
Joshua is with the Sunlight Foundation, an organization which tracks political dollars. And our thanks to you as well, Byron Tao.
Thanks for having me.
Byron is a reporter for the Wall Street Journal. And as always, we've got a great Facebook page, and you can take a look by heading to whyy.org/radiotimes. And you can also find our podcasts there. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan in for Marty Moskowain on Radio Times. Thanks for joining us.